Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also faculty associate in law and public affairs here at Princeton University.
The Russian intervention in the election, the possibility of obstruction of justice, and much more have all been driving themes in the first few months of President Trump's time in office. The scandal surrounding Russia has kept growing since the election took place. There have been discussions and investigations into everything from obstruction to collusion. And it is an issue that has really dominated national discussions about what's going on. It's consumed a lot of time in our political debate, both for Congress and for the White House. And it is still front and center as we go into the middle of the summer. There are multiple investigations taking place from Robert Mueller in the special counsel's office, conducting an investigation to multiple congressional committees, to many people in the world of journalism who are all looking into what happened. This week, yet another bombshell revelation took place via both the New York Times and the Twitter account of President Trump's oldest son, as news of a meeting last June with a Russian lawyer emerged, and the emails came directly from Donald Trump Jr. As he shared that with the rest of the world. So the president has dismissed this repeatedly as fake news, as a hoax. Some have argued, like David Brooks, that the political chattering class is making too much of this, and others, though, strongly disagree. To discuss more about where things stand on this issue and others involving the administration, we are really fortunate to have Benjamin Wittes, who's an editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, a former intellectual home of mine in the end of my graduate school years. He's the author of several books. He's the co-chair also of the Hoover Institution's Working Group on National Security, Technology, and Law. Writing for Lawfare, he has attracted a really big audience through that and through his Twitter feed. And he's become an important voice on all the questions that we face today as a nation and as a republic. So thanks for joining our show.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess I'll just start just to get updated with the news before maybe we move backward. But what was your impression of the news stories of the emails involving Donald Trump Jr. and how this, if it does, advance the story and advance the investigation?
My first reaction to it was incredulity, because it really did have this quality of an email that was too news perfect to be actually real. And, you know, the idea that somebody approaches the Trump campaign, not just the Trump campaign, but the candidate's son, with saying explicitly, you know, I'm here on behalf of the Russian government in its efforts to help you, and I want to give you dirt on Hillary Clinton, and that the response of the son is, I love this, particularly later in the summer. Like, you can't make that up. My first reaction was, to be honest, that somebody has to be pulling our legs, because it's too absurd to be true, yet it does appear to be true. In all seriousness, it's a very serious situation. And, you know, the real question is, what does it mean? And what does, and should you infer that this is the iceberg, and that we now have visibility into the broad questions of what happened? Or should you infer that there are a few tips of the iceberg that have breached the surface, but there's a much larger set of architectures of these these interactions beneath the surface. And you know, I unlike a lot of people who've, you know, who've been quick to answer the question of what it means, I don't know.
Well, unlike, let's see. So one thing about this story appears to be that, if I'm understanding the timeline correctly, on some afternoon slash evening last June in 2016, Donald Trump Jr. took this meeting, and a few hours later, Donald Trump Sr. said at some press event, he basically encouraged the Russians to do something to hack or release Hillary Clinton's emails. And so that coincidence suggests that maybe we're starting to, you know, the different parts of the picture are starting to join up.
Right. So look, and of course, it's much denser than that. The web of public and private interactions that are of concern and therefore, you know, interrelated, or you, at least you have to imagine that they could be interrelated, and you have to explore it as an investigative matter and as an intellectual matter. So, first of all, there are these speeches, you know, this meeting relatively immediately, within a few days, precedes the first major release of DNC and Clinton-related emails. Secondly, within a relatively short period of time, the candidate has called for the Russians to release emails that might have been recovered from her private server. Within a relatively short time after that, we know from the Wall Street Journal, a Republican political operative, now deceased, who claimed ties to General Flynn and other members of the Trump campaign, had actually launched an organization to negotiate the retrieval of these emails from Russian hackers. And according to one of the people whom he contacted, was actually in touch with people who may well have been genuine Russian hackers or agents of the Russian government, and was negotiating for the recovery of stolen emails. Now, whether he really had that relationship with General Flynn, and whether he really was negotiating with real Russian hackers about real emails, I do think what the episode reflects, particularly in combination with Donald Trump Jr.'s and Paul Manafort's and Jared Kushner's taking this meeting, is that if there was not active collusion by the Trump campaign with the Russian effort to interfere with the election, including by hacking emails, it sure wasn't for lack of trying. And that, you know, what we've seen so far may or may not show that there was, a successful set of interactions between the Trump campaign and Russian operatives, but it sure shows that there was the intent to do that.
So one word that now is being, every word gets unpacked, it feels like, as this unfolds. So collusion. If you could just tell our listeners, what are people looking for to understand if there was collusion? What does that actually mean? And if it didn't work, if it's shown that there were efforts to do something like this, does that dampen the legal jeopardy people would face? Does it have to be successful, in other words, to either be a crime or to be politically damaging?
Okay, so except in the world of antitrust law, collusion itself is not a crime. So in antitrust, you know, if two companies get together and make a secret deal to fix prices, you know, that's illegal. But generally speaking, the term collusion, as it's used here, is not a legal term. It's a colloquial term. And I think the reason people are using it, other than that, you know, these things have a life of their own, is that we need some word, since there was clearly a tacit cooperation that was very public between the Russians and Trump, which consisted of things like Trump publicly calling on the Russians to do stuff like this, right? It consisted of him then lying about whether they had in fact done it and covering for them. It consisted of the fawning kind of bromance between him and Vladimir Putin in public, where they said all kinds of nice things about each other. And it consisted of a whole lot of Russian propaganda on Trump's behalf that was really quite overt, right? So all of that is a sort of public tacit cooperation between the two. But then there's this other question that has arisen, which is, beyond that, is there some sense in which the Trump folks or Trump himself are complicit in the underlying covert action that the Russians took on the against the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, and on behalf of Trump and the Republicans? And so it's not enough, if that's what you're trying to show that there was this sort of tacit public interactions. You have to show something secret. And so the word that has some sort of secret deal, right, where and preferably a deal with a quid pro quo, where you're promising, you know, you release those emails and we'll lift sanctions when we get into office, right? And look, Trump's behavior has consistently raised the question of whether this sort of thing might have happened. And the fact that a whole lot of people around him had secret meetings with Russian officials that they conveniently forgot about when it was time to either testify or, you know, file their SF-86 disclosure forms or their FARA disclosure forms, necessarily raises this question. And we need a word that describes that kind of secret, one might say collusive, plotting or agreements. And so the word that, as everybody's using for it, is collusion, which is not, it's a perfectly reasonable word, but it's actually not a legal term in this context. And so one of the interesting questions is, what are the possible legal theories of liability in which this sort of thing would actually not merely be politically extremely damaging, but also, illegal or even criminal? And, you know, that question is necessarily highly fact dependent. That is, it's very hard to you can't say that collusion in and of itself is a legal problem. What you can say is that collusion would tend to raise a number of legal questions under a number of different bodies of law, but what body and how serious the question would really depend on facts that we don't know yet.
So at some level, this feeds this narrative that that pundits like David Brooks are putting forth, that somehow there's this tone that it's just more politics as usual. And I have to say, I get this tone when I follow news stories with commentators, that everything gets compressed into some narrow partisan battlefield where right and wrong and criminal and non-criminal activity just gets mashed into some pulverized dust of political argument, where something that could be a crime, something that could be treason, gets just mashed in with, well, everybody does it. And so I'm trying to get a feel for this. Now, today on Lawfare, Helen Klein-Morello and Susan Hennessy wrote a little piece on Lawfare blog asking whether, well, maybe could Russian election meddling fall under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act? Is that an example of how something here could be, in fact, a criminal action?
Right. So, yeah. So the answer is yes. Let me give you a few bodies of law that, depending on, you know, how the facts play out, may be implicated by this. So one is, we know there was a hack. We know there was a theft of information. And we know there was the distribution subsequently of that information through WikiLeaks and through other media, through other cutout outfits. So the question is, the hack was certainly criminal. And so when you talk about collusion, is there some aiding and abetting theory, right, in which you become implicated in the hack or the distribution of the information from the hack in a criminal fashion. And there are theories that could get you there.
Like the analog of receiving stolen goods.
Well, the more precise analog is, I think, some kind of aiding and abetting the theft and distribution of those goods.
If they did it in advance.
Well, so presumably they're not involved in the theft, because the penetration of the systems took place much earlier. But if you get involved and help direct the distribution of the goods, right, tell them which ones to release when, none of this, by the way, is fact that we know. But if you get involved midstream of the criminal activity, you could become party to it. Second thing is, there are theories, and I'm not an expert on campaign finance law by any means, but there are questions under the campaign finance law of if this information that Donald Trump Jr. is expecting to get is believed to have value.
It's a contribution?
Could it be seen as solicitation of an in-kind contribution, a thing of value from a foreign actor, and foreign contributions to campaigns are banned? So there are campaign finance questions. There are also, of course, espionage questions. Generally working with foreign intelligence service in covert actions against your country is frowned upon by espionage law. Now,
okay, you're being silly. You mean it's espionage?
Well, no, but be careful, right? Because in espionage, classic espionage is you giving information to the foreign intelligence service. In this situation, we're thinking about the Foreign Intelligence Service giving information to you. And so I think that's actually an interesting question, and you'd have to know a lot of information about what information flowed the other direction, if any.
I get a powerful sense out of these players, Donald Trump Jr., I guess Manafort, Jared Kushner. These are people who are probably not that well acquainted with these rules and these laws that you're talking about. I get this powerful sense out of them that they're kind of blundering around, and at the time they were, if they were thinking about it, they probably didn't think they were going to win. And they're just blundering around with these Russian forces or these sources of information, perhaps not even thinking about whether something is legal or illegal.
I suspect that's right. A combination of moral depravity and blundering. And then trying to cover it up. But I think, these are not people, nothing about this plan, this campaign bespeaks a carefully designed plot to do anything, let alone violate the law.
Before I turn to the second part of the investigation, which is obstruction of justice, let me ask one question more broadly. What does all this do to our national security institutions? It's not good. And you wrote your quote. There's a story about you in New York Magazine, and you have a great quote. You said, "I don't lead any kind of resistance. I keep warning all of our newfound admiring readers that I'm not part of that world. You know, the day we have sane government again, including, by the way, sane conservative government, I'm going back to being an apologist for the national security state."
Yep.
Maybe what does this do, right? The last few months, January on or whenever you want to start this, what does it do to our national security institutions?
Well, I mean, jokes aside, it's been terrible. Yep. The national security community, it's an unusual community because it's quite large, in terms of the number of people who work for security agencies in one way or another. And they ultimately have exactly one client. Their job is to inform presidential decision making. And it's this huge bureaucratic apparatus that's all there so that the president, there's some elements of it that deal in tactical intelligence for the military and stuff, but by and large, if you work at CIA or NSA or, you're working to inform the president and the immediate cabinet around the president. And if the president genuinely doesn't care what about any of this information, you have you really don't have much of a purpose. And if the president declares war on you, then your only constituency is your biggest enemy. And that's a really cognitively difficult experience for a lot of people. Moreover, the president has done a number of very specific things that have been, it's very hard to overstate how galling they have been to, you know, the men and women who actually do this stuff for a living. So one of them is the public rejection, or the refusal publicly to accept for a long time, the intelligence community's essentially unanimous high confidence finding that Russia was behind this hack and the goal was to aid the Trump campaign. In the course of doing that, he consistently reminds people, including when he's overseas, of the intelligence community's failures during the Iraq war. And that is a real slap in the face to people. So the second thing he did, and, you know, people have already forgotten about this in the larger public, but it has not been forgotten in the intelligence community, is the self-promotional speech he gave about crowd sizes in front of the CIA's memorial wall on the first full day of his presidency.
That feels like it would have been horrifying.
It is. It will not be forgotten. It's a little bit like, to a lot of people who work in that community, the way the Jewish community would react if you went to Yad Vashem and talked a lot about yourself. Right? I mean, it's a hallowed ground for a lot of people. And, you know, some of your listeners may not really know that wall, but that wall, it has the name of every CIA officer who's been killed in the line of duty. And then it has a star for them. And then it has a number of stars that have no names next to them, because the identities of the officers in question are still classified for one reason or another.
Right, people who are covert. And so it is a quiet space. When you're in front of that wall, it's really quite solemn, despite the fact that it's just, you just walk in.
The last thing you should be doing in that situation is talking about yourself. And, you know, people really noticed that. And then there's a final element, which is, particular to the FBI, but it's not only particular to the FBI. It's not limited to the FBI. And that's the Comey firing, and in particular, some of the things that were said in connection with the Comey firing. So, you know, Jim Comey is a complicated, controversial figure in American public discourse because of the decisions he made in connection with the Clinton email stuff. But he is not a controversial figure in the FBI building. And I've, you know, spent time walking through that building with him. And there are very few places I've ever been with a person in which you get as much of a sense of that person's relationship with that place as walking through that building with Jim. And, you know, the Bureau rank and file was furious at what happened, particularly the manner in which it was done, but also the fact that it was done and a lot of lies were told by the president, not just about Jim, but about them, specifically that the FBI was in turmoil, that a lot of FBI people were calling Sarah Huckabee Sanders to thank her for the president's decisive action in removing Jim. There was no truth to any of that. And that's a building where, you know, that's a tribal organization. It's a vertically integrated paramilitary organization. And it's also, you know, quite tribal in character. And, you know, it's hard to overstate how angry and upset people were by that. And so all of this, you know, this is a long-winded answer to your question, but all of this, and a lot of other things, takes place over a very short period of time. And I think the, you know, all of it has had major morale implications, not political in character, by the way, for a large group of people. And that's before you get to the State Department.
Right.
Which, you know, we actually have poll data on morale at the State Department.
But there is a...
I'm sorry?
I said what there is of the State Department.
And what there is of morale. you know, it's a very... You know, so as you radiate out into the larger foreign policy community, the problem gets worse, not better.
Mm-hmm. So you now... let's turn to the other part, and you became part of the story when I think Senator Collins mentioned you during the hearings. But the second issue that takes place during the presidency rather than during the campaign is whether the administration has attempted or already has obstructed justice and tried to stop this investigation. And I'd be curious, the firing of James Comey was obviously the key moment when this all came front and center. And I'd be curious to hear now that some of that has, it hasn't settled, but some time has passed. What are your impressions on that part of what we know in the investigation?
So I want to distinguish between two things that people mean when they say obstruction of justice, because they really are profoundly different from one another, and both of them have application to this situation, but they mean something different, and they implicate different government interests. So one is that obstruction of justice is a criminal offense under a number of different criminal statutes in Title 18. And in order to determine for purposes of those statutes whether an obstruction of justice has occurred, there are really two threshold questions that would guide a reasonable prosecutor in making that determination. And I think one of them is a highly technical question of whether an FBI investigation counts as a, quote, proceeding, unquote, within the meaning of the obstruction of justice statute. That's a contested point of law, and it may well be that the question of whether you could actually bring a criminal case in a setting like this would hinge on a certain set of questions related to that. The second issue, and the much more fundamental issue, is that obstruction of justice is a specific intent crime. And that is, the exact same conduct can be a serious crime, an obstruction of justice, if you mean one thing when you say certain words or do certain things, or it can be completely anodyne with the exact same conduct without that meaning. So the classic example is, if I say to you, "Nice house you got there," it'd be a shame if something happened to it. If I am, you know, a mobster, Whitey Bulger, and I say that, that's an obstruction of justice if you're a witness in a criminal case. And I'm intending to prevent you from testifying against me. On the other hand, if I'm an insurance salesman trying to sell you a homeowner's insurance policy, that is not an obstruction of justice. And so my point here is, no responsible prosecutor will make a decision about whether an obstruction of justice happened within the technical meaning of an obstruction of justice statute without a very careful evaluation of the president's specific intent in all of the reported interactions with Comey. And that will almost certainly require interviewing the president. And so on the criminal side, the answer to your question is, there are some important threshold issues that you'd need to really think through very carefully, and you'd need to develop more facts on before you could evaluate. There's another sense in which people mean obstruction of justice, and that's the sense of the congressional authority to impeach the president under the impeachment clauses of the Constitution. And if you go back over historic impeachment, some of them have alleged, some including the Richard Nixon impeachment articles of impeachment, alleged obstruction of justice, but they didn't do it with reference to the criminal statutes. They just said that he had behaved in a fashion that obstructed the due administration of justice and violated his oath to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And I think if the question is the pattern of activity that Jim Comey described in his testimony, if Congress believed him about that, and I personally have no reason not to. I think he's not a liar and the president is a liar. Would that constitute a basis for impeachment by a reasonable Congress? I have no doubt that it would.
Well, let's see. So let's back up a little bit here. So first we started talking about how one would define obstruction of justice based on criminal statute and about questions of intent. And now you've transitioned into what is more of a political question, whether Congress would and could impeach based on more or less their own definitions of what is a crime against the United States. So it seems to me that if I understand the trail of what's likely to happen, if Robert Mueller brings a recommendation to impeach, I mean, he could do that. He's constrained by criminal statute, presumably, but Congress is not. So how is that going to play out?
Now, this is a very interesting question. And so first of all, he's constrained by criminal statute in his, as long as the president is in office, he probably cannot bring a criminal case against the president. Because there is the position of the Justice Department historically is that the president, while he's in office, is not susceptible to criminal process. On the other hand, the special counsel may or may not have an obligation and certainly has some latitude to report to Congress information that may constitute grounds for impeachment. And so I think, the way you can expect Mueller's investigation to play out on that score, I think, is that I assume he will investigate it. I assume he will investigate it vigorously. And at the point at which he determines, if he determines, that there's information Congress needs to know in its own constitutional, its independent constitutional duties with respect to the impeachment clauses, he has the latitude to refer that material to Congress. And prior special prosecutors, particularly the most notable for this purpose being Leon Jaworski, in the Watergate matters, actually did send an impeachment referral to the House Judiciary Committee. Notably, that impeachment referral from Jaworski has never become public.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, could I just follow up on one other thing? And obviously, James Comey, and you believe him over the president, given the president's many false statements. Can you just share your impressions of who James Comey is? He's become such a big figure in American politics, both in the campaign and now. Just to give a better sense of who he is, so that listeners understand a little bit more of the man who is now pretty central to what's happening.
Yeah, so, this is an easy one. Jim, I wrote this at the time that he was removed. I wrote this in a New York Times op-ed, that he's the only truly subtextless person I've ever dealt with at senior levels of Washington policy. And nobody believes this because, you're always looking in a Washington figure for what the backstory is, what the what the ulterior motive is, what the strategy is. And that's actually the wrong question to ask about Jim. If you want to know why he's doing something, you just ask him and he'll tell you. He shows his work in public, and this gets him in trouble sometimes, right? This is what happened with the Clinton email stuff. He didn't just make a decision. He then went up and talked about it first in a press conference and then in congressional testimony, and he answered questions about it. He's honest, completely honest. He's not, you know, one thing you will not find in the historical record in either of his two, you know, senior level stints of in office is him saying something that turns out not to be true. Except by accident, of course, you know, people make mistakes and correct the record and stuff, but he has no public record of lying about things. And he is, his rep among people who don't like him, and there are many people who don't like him, is that he's prissy, you know, that he's kind of full of his own moral rectitude. I actually think that's not a fault that this city couldn't use a little more of, is, you know, people who take both ethics and the perception of their own actions as ethical, and the need to explain their behavior in ethical terms. I don't actually think would be a terrible thing if we had a little bit more of that, but that's the rap that Jim gets. My basic point about him is he is exactly what he seems to be. He's not very different in public than he is in private. And, you know, when he does things like go in front of those committees and answers questions for hours at a time, that's a good reflection of who he is, actually. And I've known him for a long time. We're friends. And I it's not a terrible way to introduce yourself to him to watch some of those committee hearings.
It seems that people who are figures of public and private rectitude come off as awfully retro these days.
Yeah, you know, he's somebody who is I think because he seems like a throwback, right, to this kind of Mr. Smith persona, people always want to figure out what the backstory is, right, and what the evil Machiavellian plan is, and what his real deal is. And the answer is there's no subtext. That's who he is.
Well, let's I wonder if in our time that we have remaining, I wonder if we could turn a little bit to something you wrote about recently, which is somebody who is up in line to replace James Comey, Christopher Wray. And you, yesterday afternoon, on Wednesday the 12th, you wrote about Wray's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And there's something in your essay that I wrote. I encourage people to read it. But it was your take on the confirmation hearings. And the impression I get here is that you think that he did well, but the senators on that committee left something on the table, which is the question of whether Wray really ought to get a full 10-year term. And I wonder if we could unpack that a little bit, whether something valuable has been let pass in this weird crisis where Comey's cut short, and now there's this other guy who you say is, you think he's okay, but what should happen with him?
Yeah, so it's a very complicated question, and I want to start by saying I'm not at all sure I know what the right answer to it is. I've got nothing against Chris Wray. I don't, unlike Comey, whom I know and we're friends, I do not know Chris Wray, and I certainly have no beef against him, and I'm not, I'm not making an argument that he shouldn't be confirmed. In fact, I think he should be confirmed. And I actually think he did a very good job yesterday, and some of the things he said will, I think, reassure a lot of people in the FBI about the kind of leader he means to be. And that's good, and I commend him for it.
That said, I have two major anxieties about the situation. The first is I don't understand how Chris Wray or anybody, given what happened to Comey, and let's remember that what happened to Comey was that he was the subject of individual substantive pressure by the President of the United States almost from the time he entered office until he was summarily fired in a humiliating fashion for not giving, you know, not giving the president what he wanted on substantive matters with respect to investigations. And given what happened to him, I don't really understand how anybody can walk into that job with confidence that they're going to be able to be effective and confidence that they're going to not, to the extent that they are effective, be removed suddenly and in a fashion that is, you know, malicious. And I was, quite disappointed with the members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, not with Chris Wray, by the way, who I can't fault him for not answering this question because he wasn't asked. But I am mystified that the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee didn't push him on this. Like, why does he think he's going to be able to be an effective FBI director given the circumstances in which he's nominated to run it?
Yeah, it seems like a caretaker might be in order at the moment.
Right. So that brings me to my second point, which is that Wray, if Trump gets away with this, and what this is here is the removal of the FBI director for self-interested and maybe corrupt personal reasons, and the replacement of the FBI director with a handpicked member of your own political party. And remember, Comey was a member of the party opposite the president who appointed him, and that's really the best practice of the way you should name an FBI director. I don't really see why, if that is okay, and if we just confirm that person and expect him to be able to, you know, serve a full 10-year term, I don't really see why every president won't come in, fire the FBI director, and replace him with somebody congenial to himself. And I think that direction lies a very serious degradation of the sort of institutional expectation of law enforcement as a function independent of power politics and partisan politics. And so I'm concerned, not because I have a problem with Chris Wray, but because I have a problem with the circumstances in which Wray is appointed, that the next president have the option of coming in and just as part of the expectation of his taking office, I would hope that he or she would consider removing Chris Wray and replacing him with somebody who is of the opposite party, above partisan reproach, and not tainted by the circumstances of the at least self-interested and maybe corrupt removal of Jim Comey. And so I say that with a lot of anxiety because I'm also keenly aware that done badly, first of all, I wish Wray well, and I hope he does an excellent job running the FBI, which is an agency right now that needs a lot of kind of TLC and a lot of inspired leadership. And so I would hope that he would be the kind of leader that a few years from now, whether it's, you know, after one or two Trump terms, I would want to say, of course, the next president will retain Chris Wray. But I'm aware that the proposal that I'm making, which is that the president not do that, could actually backfire and reinforce the idea that every president comes in, fires the FBI director, and installs his own favored person. So I think it's very delicate, and but I'm very concerned that we not accept as okay what happened a couple months ago and led to this appointment that the Senate considered yesterday, the Judiciary Committee considered yesterday.
It seems that's a theme for many people, that we don't accept what happened is okay. And the increasingly difficult efforts to stop that, because more and more is accepted as okay. And what is really a very unusual and in many ways unprecedented presidency. I have to ask, how is it that you have become a kind of legal journalistic think tank celebrity through this? And I ask that not to know how does it feel to be the center of attention, but what kind of responsibilities or what kind of objectives do you have now that you have this platform as you try to explain these, you know, extraordinary developments that happen? I know many journalists who are trying to figure that out, and I'd love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very weird situation for me because, you know, you don't go into the business that I went into. I wrote editorials for the Washington Post for 10 years, and I did it mostly anonymously because, you know, I was one of those people who wrote the unsigned editorials. And I left the high profile, but the invisible but high profile media market for a think tank life where I was writing, you know, pretty technical analyses in national security law. And, you know, I had a readership and a sort of very devoted community that valued my work, mostly inside of government. And there was a sort of public element to it too, but I was never one of the highest profile, you know, Brookings people by any means. And so I guess a few things changed that. One was that over the last sort of 18 months, an enormous number of people have discovered Lawfare. And, you know, that's been a complete surprise to all of us. Lawfare was always meant as a publication that was designed to be of service to people in government and designed to help, you know, help people who were doing hard national security legal policy questions, give them sort of resources to help think through some very hard problems. It was never meant as a mass publication. But the funny thing is that if you amass a group of people who have kind of bottomless depth in executive branch law, you know, presidential power law, intelligence law, military law, you know, law of armed conflict, you know, issues of abuse of power and sort of human rights, and then the president becomes Donald Trump, this group of people becomes enormously relevant to the way a lot of people, the expertise that a lot of people suddenly feel like they need. And so some of it was just an organic reaction to Lawfare in this new environment in which, you know, people had real national security anxieties, not about ISIS or, you know, but about the threat posed by their own government. And so that's one element of it. A second element of it was that in the context of Jim's firing, I made a decision, A, that there were things that he had told me that needed to become public, and B, that unlike a lot of the other people who were giving out information that needed to become public, I was in a position to do it on the record and with my name attached to it, and that the better part of valor in that situation would be not to be in another anonymous source, but to actually be as transparent as I could about what I was doing and why I was doing it. And, you know, and so, you know, I sat down with the New York Times and with the PBS NewsHour and had long conversations about what I knew and how I knew it, and they published those, and then I published, you know, another account, and so I did put myself into the story, and I did that not to be attention seeking, but to be transparent. But it did generate an enormous amount of attention. And then the final reason, or the two final reasons, is we've broken some big stories. You know, we never meant Lawfare to be a breaking news engine, but it has broken a lot of news. And it's broken a lot of analytical news. And then the final reason, which is, you know, the one that I really never imagined, but that my Twitter feed, because of this single syllable tick, which some of your listeners will recognize, became a bit of a viral sensation, particularly once Rachel Maddow had discovered it. And look, this is not the thing in my life and work that I would most like to be known for, but it has drawn a lot of people's eyes my way. And I suppose I shouldn't deny that there is an element of showmanship involved in it.
Well, we're getting close to the end here. We're towards the end. I just wanted to turn that around a little bit. The upside is that there are some technical issues having to do with national security and law that you have called attention to. The downside, I think, is that we're still in a media environment where there's still not a commonly agreed upon vocabulary for what's a real offense and what's not. Just the fact that some highly paid pundit like Brooks will say that somehow these things are just part of the normal back and forth says to me that despite the value of what you're contributing, there is still this bit of a failure to translate these findings, these things that you reported, into the national conversation. Do you have any thoughts about how to do better? Now, I hesitate to ask this because you've brought many stories to the national attention, but feels like there's still some barrier that needs to be broken. And I don't want a full answer. I just want to just some little sense of how you feel the national media environment has done in light of the strange things that have happened the last half year.
Yeah. So I may be too deep in the weeds to answer that question usefully. I mean, I sort of feel like how people operationalize the work that we're doing is not my department and it's not my job. And I think, you know, the parts of the there is no national media environment. There are many national media environments. And, you know, the major newspapers have done a simply spectacular job in reporting on these issues. And it's actually been pretty moving for me to watch that they have the number of reporters who are doing really important, valuable investigative work is quite large. The group of them is very diverse in the publications that they work for. And the amount of energy being spent is actually quite inspiring, I think. And the quality has been terrifically high. There have been mistakes. But the quality has been excellent. And so in that sense, I really admire the work that the national media is doing. Television networks, very different story.
Yeah, but people get their information from television. That's the way people are now.
Right. That's not, I can't do anything about that.
Yeah.
All I can say is if you're a listener to this and you're getting your information from cable television, you deserve to be as misinformed as you probably are. And if you don't like hearing me say that, don't tweet something nasty at me about it. Change your goddamn habits, because the problem is you. All right? If you demand something different from the television stations that you watch, or better yet, if you stop watching them and subscribe to newspapers, that will change the media environment. And if you're not prepared to do that, don't come crying to me about the national media environment. Not that your listeners are, but look, my job is to do the best
That said, there are, of course, some jewels out there, Julian, who says smart things in CNN now and then.
Look, there are good people, good analysts, good reporters working for all of these terrible network organizations. And yet the networks are not the friend of informed, serious conversation in this country. Look, my job is to do the best legal analysis that I can, to be helpful to journalists who are trying to do it, to publish stuff that needs to come out, primarily analytical work, documents. And how the system takes that and translates that into political outcomes, I don't even have a good window on that. All I know is what I can do.
Well, thank you for what you do, and we'll leave the solutions to the next show. We're out of time. Thanks again to Benjamin Wittes, who's editor-in-chief of Lawfare and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He is the author of several books, Law and the Long War, Star, Confirmation Wars, Detention and Denial. And he writes regularly for Lawfare. We urge you to read his blogs, his Twitter feed, and everything else. So that wraps up our episode. Thanks to everyone for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.